Yes, indeed. Unfortunately, constants can't be exact. If you make some constants exact that weren't, you inevitably have to demote other constants that were exact to be approximations, and that's in this story as well.
Okay, so if I made a list of things that are exact and a list of things that are approximate, give me some of the names of those things on that list, Roy.
If you will, let me get back to the little presentation, because it's all really well, I think it's reasonably well described, and then when we get to the end of it, we can discuss it in minute detail. How's that?
Go for it.
Okay, since 1954, the Kelvin has been defined as equal to the fraction 1 over 273.16 of the thermodynamic temperature of the triple point of water at which water ice and water vapor coexist in equilibrium. From now on, it will be defined in terms of joules of energy and the Boltzmann constant. This will make Avogadro's number, the electron's charge, the Planck's constant, and the Boltzmann constant absolutely defined. They will no longer be approximations. The volt will be decreased by about 100 parts per billion, and the ohm by less than 20 parts per billion. But I doubt that you'll need to worry too much about getting your meters recalibrated. Second, something here crashed. Okay, it's back again. One second. Okay, for you guys out there who are keeping score, there's some exactly defined constants have been demoted to mere approximations. These are the magnetic constant, the mu naught, the vacuum permittivity constant, epsilon naught, and the impedance of free space, z naught. All of these constants have been demoted to the best approximation based upon the experimentally derived approximations of something called the fine structure constant. This is a dimensionless physical constant characterizing the strength of the electromagnetic interaction between elementary charged particles. So some constants came out winners and other constants came out losers from the conference. But if you feel the need to recalibrate your equipment, you won't have to do it immediately. This won't go into effect until May 20th, 2019, on the World Metrology Day, to give high-end metrologists time to adjust to the new values. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
When it comes to getting my hands on some of these constants, we've got a little bit of a conflict of interest. Ease of doing it versus accuracy. In the case of 0 degrees centigrade, which I think used to be something like water, clean water at the standard temperature and pressure, where the vapor pressure and the liquid pressure are the same, and it's about to freeze at 0 degrees centigrade, or it's about to boil, that's 100 degrees centigrade. That was easy to derive. The new concept, where it's some number of coulombs of quantum or whatever, although that may be more accurate, that sounds like a more difficult thing to derive in my particular laboratory. Have I got that wrong? Over to you, Roy, KQIW.
No, Dick, you got it right. These are somewhat more complex methods of measurement. The beauty that they feel is that it locks it down to a set number, and you don't have to take out the ice and the water and calibrate it that way. Temperature will be measured as joules per Boltzmann constant. There's an equation for that. So you'll be able to just take a calculator and figure out how much joules of energy will raise the temperature in Kelvin degrees. So they kind of really like the idea that it's not going to be any more approximations. You know, in the olden days, Planck's constant was known to a certain level of precision. If you turn it on its side and you turn the kilogram to be defined by the Planck's constant, then you've kind of tweaked the kilogram a little tiny bit, but at the price of establishing Planck's constant to its absolute final value. There are no further numbers. It's zero beyond the range that they have declared it to be. All these interesting constants now are locked down, and they're interrelated with the kilogram as well. So they were very impressed with themselves in this.
With the new definition, it seems like everything is related to each other by way of an equation. But in order to enter that equation, you have to start off with something. Is the basic unit that starts all this off the charge electron? Was it 1.6 10 to the minus 19 coulombs? Is the charge of an electron, the definition of electron volt, is that the base unit that defines everything else? Roy, go ahead.
Well, I mean, they're all interrelated. Up until this vote, the unit electrical charge on an electron was an approximation as well as Boltzmann constants and Planck constants and the rest. So they've all been locked down. In some ways, they've been locked down with the association of a kilogram. It all kind of creeps up on the kilogram. Once you define the kilogram as an absolute quantity in equations that are convertible, you then come up with all the values for these constants. And so we took the 90% platinum, 10% iridium cylinder from France. We measured it out. We locked it down and measured it accordingly to all these other devices that calculate our Planck's constant and other constants, and they've kind of locked all those constants down. By the way, I actually looked up to see how much weight loss had occurred in the daughter weights from Lagrange K, and it was on the order of about 50 micrograms, or about 50 parts per billion over the last century.
A microgram would be parts per million, not parts per billion. Roy, go ahead.
Yes, but we're talking about a kilogram weight standard.
If a kilogram is now an amount of force with a certain amount of current flowing through wires at a certain distance apart, you've got a certain way of deriving that amount of coulombs of charge flow through the wire or current. They're all interrelated, but there's got to be a base somewhere that starts it all off. I can say that I've got these two people in the room, and the guy on the right hand side is 50% heavier than the guy on the left hand side. What is their weight? All I know is the relationship between the two. I've got to go down to a real weight of something to start the whole process off. So, therefore, what is the beginning unit that starts this whole process off of all these interrelationships that are now considered exact? Over to you, Roy. KGYW.
I think it's no accident that they were able to kind of construct all of these interesting interrelationships as soon as they locked down a kilogram. So I'm assuming that the kilogram is the one fluctuating aspect that was that allowed them to do all this with Planck's constant, Boltzmann's constant, and the electron charge and what have you. Unfortunately, it doesn't relate to the fine structure constant, which is why it's left hanging as an approximation, and all the constants that are derived from it are turned into approximations as well. But I think it's the weight is the ultimate, the mass. Giving a specific quantity of mass as an example is the method that they've used to lock down all these numbers.
On the there was a Veritasium in which the kilogram was an extremely smooth silicon sphere. I guess that proposal was a bid that fell by the wayside. That one was fell out of favor. Is that what happened, Roy?
No, not exactly. They repurposed. That was a perfect silicone crystal sphere. that was designed to be exactly 1 kilogram of weight based upon Legrand K. And then they did X-ray studies to be able to calculate how many silicon atoms were in this perfect sphere, and that's how they came up with the standard calculation of Avogadro's number. So they used it as part of the of setting the constant values. That was where they used that. But it, again, goes back to the weight of the kilogram. If you didn't have a kilogram, you wouldn't be able to have calculated Avogadro's number based upon a 1 kilogram perfect silicon sphere.
That perfect silicon sphere, if you kept that in a vault in Washington, D.C., that could be our local Grand K. But for you and I to produce one of those so that I can independently derive a kilogram, for you and I to do that in our laboratory, that strikes me as a heroic effort, and you and I are not likely to do that. Over to you, Eric. Right.
Well, I would agree with you, Dick, and it's not meant to be. This was a kind of, again, a one-time where it said Avogadro's number. So it's no one's going to lock away this silicon sphere except for historical purposes and then pull it out sometime later on. It's a done deal. I don't know if silicon is very good for what they did to measure it and calculate the number of atoms. I don't know if you would pick a silicon crystal as something that's very enduring. They kind of picked the platinum-iridium alloy because it was non-reactive, didn't really oxidize, and by putting some iridium in it, it made it a much more, much stronger piece of material that didn't break. I would assume you drop that lovely little silicon crystal and you're going to wreak havoc with those numbers.
And even though the outer surface of that silicon sphere might appear to be nearly perfect, how do you know that there isn't a flaw in the crystal structure somewhere in the middle of that thing? Over to you, Roy.
Well, I mean, vaguely, like you were talking about the time domain reflectometer, they exposed X-rays onto it to find the fine structure of that ball. I would assume if there were any significant artifacts, it would have been picked up on the X-ray diffraction pattern, which they didn't see. So I'm assuming that it's a similar situation there.
In the case of something that's microscopic, X-ray diffraction works like a charm. I'm having trouble believing that X-ray diffraction is going to penetrate to the middle of that sphere, which is, let me pick a number, 10 to the 28 molecules, and it's going to find the flaw in the crystal structure that deep down. I don't think you're going to resolve that with X-ray diffraction. Over to you, Roy.
Well, I guess it really has to do with the amount of flux density on the X-ray emitter. If you pour enough in it, I would assume that you get the proper results. Since this is how they publish the results, and these guys don't kind of do this part-time, I assume they've established pretty good... there's a lot of knowledge, thankfully, about silicon crystals because they're the basis of semiconductors and probably at this point trillion-dollar industries. So there is a heck of a lot of knowledge about making silicon crystals. And if they don't make them perfect, then it costs them. They slice them down and they make chips. So if they weren't able to detect that there weren't any defects in the crystal lattice, it would kind of bite them on the backside. So I'm assuming the technology is well understood by these specialists and it works for them. Any other comments, questions, or what have you? I sort of found it fascinating, although voltage and resistance will change. It changes very, very minimally, but I was fascinated by the concept that you really do have to change the definition of the volt by 100 parts per billion. Again, it's not going to make any difference with anyone that I'm aware of, but apparently the other values have been tweaked repeatedly through time, but the volts and ohms kind of got locked down. about 30, 40 years ago. No one's bothered to tweak them until this conference.
West NK2LEG.
Say again?
West NK2LEG. Speed of light.
What about the speed of light? The speed of light's been defined as well.
Could you comment, please? Thank you.
Okay, I don't know exactly what the question might be, except that they have defined, because they defined the distance of a meter in terms of the speed of light, it kind of does it, you know, fixes it by itself. If you're interested, it's 288,792,450 meters per second is the speed of light in a vacuum. And again, as long as you get to lock down meters and lock down seconds, you can lock down the speed of light as well.
So I think the meter, has that been measured or is that calculated?
It initially was measured, but finally they locked it down with calculations.
Now, the meter, I think, is defined as a certain given amount of time that a RF wave in free space in a vacuum, the amount of time it takes to travel a certain distance. At one time, it was a given number of cycles of a cesium beam in a vacuum. Over to you, Roy.
Well, that's the basis, that's the definition for what a second is. A second, if you kind of look it up, they'll give you a number, and they'll tell you that it's based upon cesium-133. I think the way they phrase it is hyperfine splitting frequency of cesium-133 atoms. And they take it down as, it's a long number, it's 919-263-1770 hertz. So the second is defined on the basis of the oscillation of cesium-133, and that also refers back to the measurement of a meter, which also measures back to the speed of light per meter. So they're all kissing cousins, thankfully. Otherwise, this would be a mess.
VDH with a comment. That nine number is a 9 gigahertz signal. That sounds like it's a real measurement. Maybe that's what it's all based on. VDH, go ahead.
I think what the other gentleman was referring to about the speed of light was the fact that epsilon zero and mu zero are being tweaked. And they, I think C is defined in terms of 1 over the square root of mu zero epsilon zero. Go ahead.
Well, that's unfortunately the old definition. They've completely moved that totally out of it because they're now all three of them, epsilon zero, z zero, and mu zero, are all interrelated to the fine structure constant, which is not locked down by anything. So it depends upon purely experimental evidence for its value, and all those three values are now able to float as imprecise approximations of their value, whereas the Coulomb is now defined differently. I think that the Coulomb is defined something like the inverse of the charge on an electron, because E is 1.6, et cetera, times 10 to the minus 19, and that's in Coulomb, so if you invert it, you get the electrical charge of a Coulomb. So they've now kind of defined it along with the other constants of things that are interrelated to each other, as opposed to the fine structure constant.
At one time, I think an ampere was defined as the amount of current flowing that gives you an amount of charge that flows as 1 coulomb per second. Has that been changed also, Roy?
Well, I think that's actually the new definition for it. I think previously it had a rather classical description of two pieces of infinitesimally thin diameter wire 1 meter apart, and the force that current would have, and that was the description for an ampere at that time. But it's now been replaced with the concept of Coulomb per time base, Coulomb per second, if you will.
Question, H2LVG.
Do you have a question?
Yes, is the kilogram the definitive basis for all what we're talking about? Thank you, go ahead.
For most of the things we've been talking about, it's the one kind of variable that knocks everything down. If you redefine the kilogram a little bit, all the other values kind of get redefined as well. So once we have defined the kilogram in a way that, in order presently to definitively say what a kilogram is, you got to call the guys in France, they pull out the cylinder, and you have that kilogram. From May on, all you have to do is look in a textbook for the proper values of the current for a kibble meter, a kibble scale, and you'll be able to generate your own 1 kilogram standard if you have enough money to have a kibble scale. But it'll be able to be put in a book. You couldn't put La Grande K in a book. It wouldn't fit.
I thought in France they had the Grand K and then 6 sister units that's also kept in the same place. So if you and I want to calibrate our American standard for a kilogram, I am guessing at a reasonable price it will compare it to one of the 6 sisters. I am guessing you pay a much bigger price to compare it against La Grande K. Is that possibly what goes on? Roy, go ahead.
To a degree, I don't think, unless you kind of the President of the United States, you can demand to have it measured against La Grande K. I think they treat it very gingerly because every time you touch it, you can screw things up. So I think their primary use for the mother of all La Grande Ks is to make sure that the sister standards are identical in mass. Once they've kind of calibrated it to the sister masses, they futz around with the sister masses with much more alacrity than they would La Grande K itself.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Not related. I was just wondering if Eric was on frequency. You know, I got a buzzing noise on the Selva machine on 375. I mean, you can listen to it, but it's buzzing pretty bad. Deck?
Yeah, we already discussed that earlier, and Eric is going to search that one down as to where the buzz is occurring. When you're on 2.5, you come out of 8.5 clean, but you're noisy on 9.75. If you go into 9.75, you come out of 9.75 clean, but you come out of 8.5 with a buzz. So there's a buzz in the linking in both directions is what's been discovered so far. Paul, go ahead.
Okay, I heard you discussing something with Eric earlier, but I didn't know you were talking about Selman. Okay, very good.
Y2H.
Go ahead, Lou.
So, Roy, isn't the kilogram, isn't it now based on Planck's constant?
Yes, Lou, that's exactly it. What they did, as I mentioned last week, there was this wonderful invention called the kibble scale. They placed a definitively standard kilogram into the kibble scale and used it to calculate Planck's constant lock value, so there's no more digits after the digits that they could measure on the kibble scale, and you can now use the same Kibble scale to reverse the process, plug in the Planck's constant, and be able to tell the mass of the object you're measuring on a given Kibble scale.
Roy, the Grand K that's sealed in this museum, so to speak, in France, in Paris, I think that was defined and set, I'm going to pick a number, 1860, 1870, something like that. By what means did they come up with that as the standard at that time, if you happen to know? Over to you, Roy.
Well, it was my understanding that prior to that, there was a French standard called the Grave, which was basically a centimeter of water that approximates a gram. So they had a kind of rough approximation of what a gram would be. So I guess they measured 1,000 centimeters of water at a given temperature and locked it down to that piece of platinum iridium alloy.
That sounds reasonable.
Yeah, I mean, everything eventually, if you have enough historical context, things follow each other. No one just kind of woke up in the middle of the night and decided that a piece of platinum iridium with a certain dimension, we're going to call it a kilogram. So there's always things that happen before that kind of gives you a sense of what direction technology is going in. I mean, you have to be clairvoyant to figure out where it will lead. And I remember reading so many popular science articles of what the future would bring. We should have had flying cars at least 30 years ago.
US-2N.
Yes, Paul.
I like the original description of the meter, when it was from the North Pole to the equator, and I think they took 10 million, they divided that by 10 million. At least that was understandable. Now this is really getting complicated. It's going to be a situation where only the physicists will be able to figure this out. By the way, it was in Newsday. Your kilogram story was made into Newsday. I think it was yesterday's paper or the day before. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, it pretty much made the news all over. I mean, this is they're called metrologists. I mean, most people don't even know what metrologists are, but these guys who really take measurements serious are metrologists, and they say that this is one of the most important votes made by such conferences in at least half a century, if not a whole century. So this is sort of historical, and I understand how the other more practical examples make better sense for people, because they can kind of see it in their mind's eye, but it's not reproducible, and it's not easily measured. I mean, yeah, you can conceptualize a distance and then divide it by a million, but would you really like the job of doing the measurement and then doing the division? So it's best if you could write these things in a piece of paper and transmit them to an alien intelligence who's on Oumuamua, say. You could do that with all these constants. They are referable purely on a textual basis, whereas the old definition of the meter and the old definition of the kilogram, you pretty much had to have one at hand. So, I don't know. I tend to think that this is a good thing, personally, even though it requires us to kind of stretch our brain around quantum mechanics, which I know some people don't really enjoy, but that seems to be the trend.
Now I think they're doing the propagation of an electromagnetic wave to define a meter.
If the meter used to be 10 million units to go from equator to pole, that doesn't strike me as a convenient measurement. I mean, in the 1800s, you and I could give an estimation of the diameter of the Earth, but I can't believe that they knew it to six decimal places, so to speak. Over to you, Roy.
Well, that's the sort of the problem. It's open to a lot of interpretation and a lot of error. I will agree with Paul. It has a better conceptual quality that you could talk to people about it and they could fit it inside their head. I don't think it's a great standard because of what we were talking about, but it certainly, to most people, makes a lot more sense than to start talking about cesium oscillations and the speed of light and the standardization of time and all these other things that give more than enough of a headache to a lot of people. So conceptually, I can understand why that would have been a better standard. As a standard itself, I think it stinks because it's not reproducible and it's prone to error. But conceptually, to explain it to the average guy, it's much easier. Yes, Lou.
It's true they redefined the number of physicists it takes to change a light bulb from 10 to 9.
That was another conference that did that.
Was that the recent geek contest conference, which I think was held in Stony Brook?
I don't know. Lou, you brought up the subject. Do you have a legitimate conference where that was a topic for discussion?
Not just the recesses of my dark mind here. By the way, Roy, I don't know if you looked at the chat room. I just sent you a message on... I had set that up when John was around, and I made you moderator, so you have some ability now to... You know, kick people out or clear the room, clear the chat, etc.
Yes, I saw it, Lou. Thank you very much. I mean, fortunately, I never had any problem. I've been doing this for a year now. It's amazing to me. But and people have been very nice and polite, and I haven't had to kick anyone. But I appreciate the power. With all power goes responsibility, so I will treat your power responsible. Thank you very much, Lou.
Very good, yeah. As Paul said, yeah, I happened to catch Newsday the other day. I don't read it that often, but the article was there, and they, you know, talked about the meter. And they time out a certain amount of time, and they see how long, you know, propagation-wise it is. And as far as measuring from, like, the pole to the equator, yeah, that does seem rather probably beyond their capabilities back in the day. And then, you know, what about topographical perturbations, mountains and things? You know, I don't know how they even did that. And of course, they're not talking about the magnetic pole because that moves around. So there you go.
Well, like most things, they start with a random approximation, and then they redefine it and redefine it and redefine it, and then the music stops, and then they lock the numbers down for until people get angry and upset or discover some new amazing thing that has to cause it to be redefined. So I think it was reasonable what they did. I mean, if you're a big fan of impedance in free space, the fact that it's no longer an absolute number, that it was locked down previously by the same group of people, it's now been set adrift and demoted. So that's the nature of constants, here today, gone tomorrow, I guess. Okay, anyone with any other topic, comments about this particular story? Otherwise, I will move on to the next one.
At one time, the impedance of free space was defined as 120 pi, roughly 377 ohms. Has that changed also during this procedure, Roy?
Yes, I'm afraid so. It has been redefined as an aspect of the fine structure constant, which is not a lockdown constant, but a experimentally derived one. So it is no longer defined that way by these people, but has been allowed to float. I mean, it's a shame because it was a nice, simple equation. You could do it without even a calculator, but that's the nature of things. Anyway, if anyone else has any comments, feel free to push the push-to-talk button. Otherwise, I'll move on to the next story. Okay. Also, referring back to an old story from last week, we were discussing packing mosquitoes to ship sterile mails using the post office in order to limit the infection carrying mosquitoes in local populations. And I actually heard back from someone involved in similar mosquito studies, and he was concerned that this kind of shipping might not kill mosquitoes, but impair them enough to limit their ability to breed and block breeding of the local fertile males. He did say that he will try this method and get back to me about how good he finds it to be. Now, there was some disagreement last Sunday regarding where mosquitoes are located on the biological tree of life. Now, first introduced by Linnaeus in 1735, he wrote this very interesting hierarchy. It goes from kingdom to phylum to class to order to family to genus, and then finally to species. Now, there are six kingdoms that they include animal, plants, fungi, and there are three other kingdoms that are basically very odd single-cell organisms. Now, the phylum arthropod is ensconced in the animal kingdom, and that contains the class insect, which also includes the species, the group of mosquitoes. So mosquitoes, unfortunately, are animals. There might be another kingdom for that list, by the way. Canadian scientists have identified microscopic creatures that are so unlike anything seen before, they had to create an entirely new branch on the evolutionary tree to slot them in. Let me drop for a second. A new paper published this week in Nature offers the first genetic analysis of an organism called Hemimastigotisa, rare and poorly understood group of single-celled organisms. Biologists have known about these organisms for well over a century, but only now can Hemimastigotes be officially slotted into the evolutionary tree of life, a process more formally known as phylogeny. And by doing so, scientists have stumbled upon a completely new branch on the tree of life, one dating back billions of years. Researchers found two different species of Hemimastigosinos already known and one completely new to science in soil samples collected along the Bluff Wilderness Trail in Nova Scotia, Canada. The previously known species is called Speronema, and the new one was dubbed Hemimastix, which means rapacious hairy ogre in the language of the Mi'kmaq First Nation people of Nova Scotia. These single-celled free-roaming predators feature two rows of hair-like flagella, which they use for locomotion and grasping onto prey. Hemimastix feeds by connecting its mouth, if it can be called that, to the surface of its equally microscopic prey and sucking up the victim's cytoplasm. Hemimastigotes cannot be classified as animal, plant, fungus, or bacteria, but they are eukaryotes, having complex cells and a clearly defined nucleus. Eukaryotes that can't be slotted into these conventional groupings are called protistas, kind of a grab bag grouping of sometimes unclassifiable eukaryotes, such as Hemimastigotes. Aside from describing them as eukaryotes, protists scientists haven't been able to place them anywhere within the file.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Sorry about that. Using a new technique called single-cell transcriptomics, researchers were able to tease large amounts of genetic material from the two species of Hemimastigotes. The entire genome cannot be extracted, but enough information was gleaned for the researchers to perform a phylogenetic analysis. Virtually all eukaryotes belong to either animal, plant, or fungi kingdoms, but some eukaryotes cannot be classified as such and are deemed protists. It was clear from their analysis that Hemimastigotes didn't belong to any of the known kingdom-level groups or even to the known supergroups of several kingdoms together, like the one that includes both animals and fungi, remarked one of the researchers in this discovery. This one little collection of organisms is a whole new group at that level, all on its own. It's a branch of the tree of life that has been separate for so very long, perhaps more than a billion years, and they had no information on it whatsoever. Let me drop for a second. In the case of the new study, the phylogenetic analysis placed Hemimastigotes on a major new branch that now sits alongside the pre-existing sister branches of other eukaryotes. Such is the nature of science, always reconsidering, always making better sense of our world. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, on to the next. The Food and Drug Administration is not doing enough to ensure that supplements don't contain unlabeled... Having a problem here. 1 second. Unlabeled, potentially dangerous drugs, according to new research published in a few weeks ago in JAMA's, that's the Journal of American Medical Association, Network Open. More than half the time, the study found the FDA doesn't enforce recalls of supplements that knowingly include unapproved prescription drug ingredients. The FDA regularly screens supplement products to see if they contain unapproved pharmaceutical agents, which are typically added to create the product's advertised effects. Tainted supplement products are then recorded in a public database set up by the FDA Center for Drug Evaluation Research. Now, digging into this database, the researchers found that the FDA had singled out more than 700 supplement brands from 2006 to 2016. The overwhelming majority of these supplements were sold as sexual enhancement aids or weight loss treatments with hidden ingredients such as sildenafil citrate, the active ingredient of the well-known drug Viagra, also the antidepressant duloxetine, and also the laxative phenylphthalein. But the agency only sometimes took any strong action after identifying these products. Let me drop for a second. 46% of the products had a voluntary recall issued by the supplement company that had been requested and amplified by the FDA, while 44% of the time, just a public notification was released by the agency. From 2012 to 2016, the lack of recalls only became more common, with 72% of products getting an informal warning. And though the FDA had had the ability to issue its own mandatory recall since 2011, thanks to a law that expanded its enforcement power, it never did so. Similarly, the FDA only once used its ability to seek a federal investigation and possible charges against the supplement manufacturing company. Even voluntary recalls can't necessarily stop people from being exposed to tainted supplements. Researchers found that supplement brands have been spotted still sitting on the shelves after they've been recalled, while consumers have largely been unaware of the recalls taking place at all. Other studies have also found traces of unapproved substances and brands purchased after a recall was lifted. Let me drop for a second. Without a substantial overhaul in how the FDA can regulate these products, recalls remain the most direct tool available to protect the public from bad supplements. And the agency's reliance on public warnings doesn't seem to be up to the task. More than once, according to current studies, the FDA issued two or more public alerts for the same damn product, with the second alert warning against the new drug ingredient, suggesting that the first alert didn't do anything to deter the companies. Let me drop for a second. Because of the lack of quality control behind these products, which are often made overseas, there's no telling how much of an ingredient is in any single pill you take. In high enough dosages, the ingredients commonly found in tainted supplements, such as ephedrine and sildenafil, are known to cause heart and respiratory problems, along with seizures and even death sometimes. And a 2015 study once found that the supplements overall send more than 20,000 people to the emergency room annually. It's not just legally available prescription drugs that are the problem. Last year, researchers informed the FDA of their research showing that experimental stimulants never approved in the U.S. are being added to supplements, research that others have confirmed. But to date, they've seen no significant action taken by the agency to either regulate or warn the public about these drugs. Let me drop for a second. The important take-home here is recognizing that supplements can be sold for anything, regardless of the actual evidence supporting their claims. And the products that are most likely to have hidden drugs are those that are promoted as if they will improve your workout, your sex life, or help you lose weight. So the advice of one of these researchers involved gives to patients who want to use supplements is to only use single ingredient supplements and to not buy supplements that are riding a fan. Bad. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2M, what did you say at the end? Don't buy supplements that are doing what?
Try and get supplements that are single chemical supplements, and don't try riding a fad, an FAD. You know, if someone has figured out that taking this magic elixir is going to let you have a good night's sleep or a better sex life or live forever, fads usually are too good to be true because they are too good to be true.
Okay, I got it. But yeah, you didn't pop out. I just didn't understand exactly what you said. Very good. So all these regular vitamins that people take that they've been taking forever, these one a day vitamins, and that's probably all safe. It's the ones that come out that tell you that you're gonna have, you know, better vision. You know, take this now. They're the ones that you would worry about.
Well, yeah, Paul, those are the ones I'd be highly suspicious of, because there's always guys in the back room who want to add a little bit something extra with a kick that really, you know, gets the customers going. Unfortunately, there are times that multivitamins have been contaminated with other ingredients. There are times that just recently that a medication was contaminated. So, you know, the vitamin industry is not completely 100% safe, but generally speaking, you are much more safer if you stick to standard multivitamins or specific vitamins than if you go for the snake oil of the wonder drugs that have been offered. You know, every so often you'll see these claims, and then at the very bottom there's in tiny, teeny print, the FDA has not found any use or any medicinal value for these things. There's a certain thing that they're selling for people, cognitive loss from senility. And there's absolutely no indication it does anything except make the companies that sell it wealthier. But it doesn't do any harm, but it probably doesn't do any good, and it probably costs a lot. So those are my words on that type of subject.
Okay, very good. I know it was a push by doctors I knew out here for vitamin D. They wanted tests to be done on a regular basis. A lot of people's insurance didn't cover it. But then that led to eventually people taking a lot of vitamin D pills. So, but I guess that turned out to be okay. I think they were right about that. But if all of a sudden there's a study for some weird thing where you're going to lose 100 pounds, that you got to watch out for. Very good. I'll be listening. This is WS1.
Okay, very good, Paul. You got to be a little bit concerned about vitamins such as vitamin E and vitamin D, because they're not water-based, they're oil-based, so it's far easier for you to overdose on them and get into trouble, whereas if you stick to the water-based vitamins, the worst that can happen, as long as you have an intact kidney, is you'll have the most expensive urine in the area. A and D, you know, you don't want to take too much of this stuff. You can take too much water, so you certainly can take too much vitamins. But the body is more forgiving for water-based vitamins than oil-based.
Okay, so this guy was probably right. And the idea of people getting tested on a regular basis, you know, like once a year, you know, for that, well, for vitamin D anyway. Because if they're taking too much, they would be told that. Or are you saying it's not that the vitamin D, that not that too much vitamin D is getting into this, maybe too much
mercury or whatever the bad substance, bad chemicals are that are in the pill that are also going into your body. What are you saying? I know they had problems with mercury years ago, but you know, some kind of a substance that's making things go bad, or is it too much vitamin D that's making things go bad?
Well, Paul, as I said, you can overdose on anything, including water, but you can more easily overdose on oil-based, fat-based vitamins like vitamin A and vitamin C. So it's not the contaminants within the vitamin D. It's purely the vitamin D. If you take ridiculously large amounts of vitamin C, ascorbic acid, you have all kinds of problems, including kidney stones, but there are other things that can happen. So all these things have a side effect and have a dosage where they complicate things. Oil-based vitamins are more difficult for the body to get rid of, so it makes it more problematic. And, of course, you realize that vitamin D is a naturally occurring vitamin. If you give your body some ultraviolet light, it'll make its own vitamin D. But since people don't, they put it in milk and a whole bunch of other things, and in a multivitamin. If you take a little bit, you have no problems. If you take a ridiculous amount, you start to have problems. If you have a vitamin D deficiency, you can end up having calcium problems, and it accelerates bone thinning and osteoporosis and premature fractures of bone. So that's another complication to this thing.
Okay, well, then you would agree that people should be tested, at least for vitamin D, and this way if they stay within that range, they know they're okay. If they're too low, you're saying that might cause a bone problem, or too high might cause some other kind of problem. So I think it's good that they get tested once a year. I think the insurance company should cover that on a regular basis.
What is the condition you get if you have an excess of vitamin D, Roy?
Well, you end up with deposits because your body is attempting and failing at clearing it out of your system. So it produces, I believe, serious irritations while your liver is trying to get it out, extract it. And you basically poison your liver. You really got to go completely wonkers crazy with these dosage. I mean, you got to kind of finish off a bottle of vitamin D every day for terrible things to happen. So it's not quite, you're not going to see a lot of cases of this. You'll see probably as many cases of this as you do with polydipsia, where people consume gallons and gallons of fluids in a 24-hour period. It's unusual, but unfortunately it's doable, and human beings seem to think everything that's doable, someone's done.
Is the W2VL amateur radio repeater system.
Now, iodine is something that a body needs, and they have put iodine in salt. They call it iodized salt. Is that the only way that we get a sufficient amount of iodine? If I'm a person who consumes very little extra salt, am I possibly iodine deficient? Over to you, Roy.
Well, I mean, there are other actual natural ways of getting iodine. It's not only because you have to realize what happened before mankind iodinized salt. If you have fish in your diet, that should be more than sufficient to get the iodine from the fish. And, you know, there are other bits and pieces of food. It's always a good idea to not kind of lock down and have one specific type of food every day of your entire life, because invariably you end up with deficiencies. There was one very strange case of a guy in England who was on, I kid you not, a potato chip diet. He lived for about 5 or 6 years on potato chips, and he didn't kill himself, but I wouldn't call him the most healthy guy in the block.
Comment.
Yes, someone with a comment?
Yeah, hi, this is Tim, N2RDB. I've been listening to the net, and if you're worried about iodine, shrimp, any kind of shellfish, really, and kelp, seaweed in general, general also. That's, and if you want a good natural calcium supplement, try sesame seeds. But you can, as you said, you can't stick to just any one thing. In all things, moderation. And to RDB.
Thank you very much, Tim. I have a couple of slogans that I'm developing for this science med. One is all things in moderation. The other is causation is not always correlation. So I'm going to get T-shirts made up for that for the group. Anyway, anyone else have any comments before we move on to yet another topic that's slightly related?
Yeah, one more thing.
Yes.
In all things moderation. Well, you know, Jesus said it. Look what happened to him. Socrates said it. Well, actually, look what happened to him, too. You know, it seems that anyone who came along with good advice to try to help us, society kind of turned against them and killed them. So, beware. N2RDB.
Well, I certainly hope that this science talk doesn't end with me having to take poison. So, on that note, any last words, and we'll move on to the next topic.
Don't worry, Roy. I believe that science is a candle in the dark. That comes from one of Carl Sagan's old books.
No, I think it has been one of the greatest gifts we've given ourselves in civilization. But ultimately, it still is a tool, which is unfortunately another one of my great slogans. Just like a hammer, you can build a house or you can cave in your neighbor's skull. Science is just a means to an end. Knowledge is valuable. You can do good things, you can do bad things. I always like to think that given the chance, the more knowledge we have, the better chance we have of our natures of our better angels to do the right thing and learn some wisdom. But, you know, call me an optimist, which is a novel term for me. Anyway, on to the next. Heart disease has long been the number one killer in the United States, but a new study out this week is the latest to suggest that it's only a matter of time before the second leading cause... One second. I'm having a little problem with my little text here. I'll be right back. Okay. A new study out this week is the latest to suggest that it's only a matter of time before the second leading cause of death, cancer, becomes more commonly fatal for the average person. On a brighter side, though, that's largely because we've gotten better at preventing heart disease deaths and living longer, not because cancer deaths are rising. The researchers hailing from Stanford University Medical Center looked at death records across the country from 2003 to 2015. On a county-by-county level, they figured out that the leading cause of death for each year. In 2003, they found heart disease was the leading cause in 79% of the counties, but by 2015, it was only the leading cause in 59% of the counties. Now, cancer, meanwhile, was the leading cause of death in just 21% of the counties in 2003, but by 2015, that figure was up to an amazing 41% of counties. The team's findings were published just this last Monday in the Annals of Internal Medicine and are especially surprising. Scientists from the Center of Disease Control and Prevention, the agency responsible for publishing yearly mortality data, have themselves predicted that cancer will overtake heart disease as the leading cause of death by 2020. The transition has largely been fueled by an especially profound drop in the death rate from heart disease compared to other diseases. A 2016 study in the Journal of American Medical Association, for instance, found that the death rate for all causes nationally had dropped by 44% from 1969 to 2013, but a whopping 68% drop heart disease in particular. Over that same time period, the cancer death rate dropped as well by 18%. Let me drop for a second. The same pattern was seen in the current study. After adjusting for age and sex, the heart rate the heart disease death rate dropped by 28% over the 12-year period, while the death rate for cancer dropped by 16%. But by looking at deaths on a county level, researchers were able to see that this good news isn't universal. As with so many health-related things, wealth plays an all-too-important role. In counties where people reported a low median income, the death rate from both heart disease and cancer declined much less than it did in high-income counties. Heart disease was also much more likely to remain the leading cause of death in these low-income counties. There's more than one reason for this gap. Poorer people are more likely to smoke, and they're less likely to quit. And